Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. We have Candace Jay from Fresno.
Come on, Candace.
Hi, everyone. This is by far the biggest meeting I've ever been to in my whole entire life, so I just want to say that. Wow, what an awesome group that you guys have here and how you guys run things. I really appreciate that. Welcome to every single newcomer that's here that raised their hand and announced themselves, and especially the ones who didn't. I know that for a while it took me a long time to be able to announce myself as that. So my name is Candace, and I am definitely an alcoholic. My sobriety date, if you want to know, it's not really, sometimes not a big deal to other people. It's a damn big deal to me and to my family members and loved ones and my friends. And my sobriety date is 10-1-10. I didn't take that day. My higher power did. I just want to talk a little bit about what it was like, and I hope that that you hear some similarities. I'm pretty sure you will, because I'm not terminally unique. I don't have any great grand story of, you know, knock down, drag out police. Oh yeah, I do. Never mind. You should check my notes. Sorry. What it was like on a serious note was I was an only child. My parents, after they had me, said, hell no, are we having any more? And I grew up wanting to fit in. I wanted people to like me. That was my main objective in life. And I did that for many years. And the first time I ever had a drink and consumed alcohol, I was 17 years old. I had already tried a lot of drugs before that. And drinking was different. And the first time that I drank, I was invited to a party by all the popular girls in my high school that never spoke to me or even looked my way. And of course, I was like, yeah, I'll come, you know, of course. I think you'll see how the other half lives, you know. I was a nerd. I got trash canned all the time. And I picked up trash for money. Yeah. I said that extra loud so you guys would ask me about it after the meeting. And what happened was, and what it was like when I first drank alcohol was I went to a party, and it was at the house in the Bluffs. And if you're familiar with Fresno, those are like the big houses that I'll never live in. Put it simply. And when we walked in, I saw they had two separate bars set up. And they had alcohol that lined the whole counters, both of the counters there, in their kitchen and in their bar room. They actually had a bar room with pool tables and everything else, dart boards. And I walked in and I saw everybody drinking and I saw all the alcohol. First thing I thought of, and I still remember it like it was yesterday, was, man, this is going to be fun. The second thing I thought and I looked at and I noticed was that people were nursing their drinks. And I thought to myself, man, I'm going to drink a lot more than you. And I did. You know, I did. And I consumed so much alcohol that night, I should have died that night from alcohol poisoning or complications from it. But I didn't. And I'm here to tell you about it. And what it was like for me is my drinking was from the very first time I drank, I blacked out. And that became kind of a pattern for me, that I blacked out most times when I drank. In the beginning, it was a little bit of fun. I've heard people in the room share that, you know, it was fun at first, and then it was fun with problems, and then it was just crap. And for me, I think I thought it was fun, but looking back, since my higher power saved me and the God of my understanding and brought me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I see now that it was never fun. And I was, from the very start, right out the gate, I was out of control. I had moments of fun times followed by, as the book says, a still worse relapse. I would try to get better. I would try to go out with the intentions, great intentions, not to drink that much, you know. And what ended up happening is that the nights that I said I wasn't going to drink that much, I drank the most I had ever drank up until that point, you know. If anybody can relate to that, I hope you can. My actions got really dangerous. I started to put people who were with me driving and riding in the car with me. I started to put people all the time in harm's way. I would drive on under the influence of drugs. I would drive especially when I was drinking. And this is all still before I was 18 years old. So. Moving forward, you know, I just wanted everyone to like me. I didn't want to make anyone mad, and so whatever and wherever I was at, if they had alcohol, of course I'm going to drink it, because that'll make me funnier, and it'll make me prettier, and it'll make you just want to hang out with me, and that's all I ever wanted, you know. And I met a young man when I was in high school, and I got married. And he was so cool, and we were together like 6 years, and then I got married to him, and everything changed. What I realize now today in sobriety is he didn't change. My drinking progressed. You know, and this illness that I have and this disease that I have of alcoholism is a progressive and deadly illness, and it absolutely progressed for me. And I got tired of him not wanting to go out to bars with me at 3 in the morning. I couldn't figure out why he didn't want to go. And so I told him he was boring. I told him he had nothing that I wanted. He didn't offer anything that I wanted. And so I filed for divorce when I was 24. And that's when my drinking really took a real dangerous turn. And I went out every night. And I don't know to this day, I don't know how I held on to a job at that point. I drank every night. I went out by myself to bars in Fresno. If anyone knows that Fresno, that's not a good idea. Not then it wasn't, and it's not today. And I started to lie, cheat, steal, and be completely just a grenade around people. You know, anyone who I was around, anyone who cared anything about me, I ripped their life apart. I tried to do a geographic a couple of times. The first time was to Arkansas. If you hear a little southern twang, it's because when I get nervous, I start talking like this. I don't know why. Because I drank a lot in Arkansas. In fact, I think I went to a whole new level when I was in Arkansas. But I tried to do a geographical to my aunt's house, and when I took the train there, and I took the Amtrak, and it took 8.5 days. Because Texas is a really big state. And I tried to sober up on the train ride. And I accomplished that unless you count a whole bunch of marijuana. But anyway. And I got to the train station. I arrived in Arkansas, and I arrived in Little Rock. The big, fabulous town of Little Rock. And my aunt was there to pick me up, and when I got in her car, I was like, "Hi, Aunt Cindy." She's all, "Hey, girl. I am so glad you're here." And she constantly drove ever since that day that I moved there. She drove all the time, I came to find, with a nice Crown Royal and Dr. Pepper. Yeah, and they would, she'd pull up to the drive-through liquor store. That made it so convenient for alcoholics there. And she'd drive up, they'd already have it ready. They'd know her car, and they'd be like, "All right, Crown pick, here she goes." You know, I don't know how they didn't get it confused with the cop cars, but I don't know. And I tried to do that geographical. The second geographical I tried to do because I thought, you know, it's not about me. It's not about my problem I have with alcohol, right? If you have a problem with the way I drink, it's not me. So I thought, well, maybe if I move, I can get away from all these people that have a problem with the way I ingest alcohol, you know. It didn't have nothing to do with me. And so I moved to Nevada. Another big, fabulous city. Biggest little city in the world, right? So I moved to Reno, a little town outside of Reno, and I tried to start over again. Once again, tried to be a good girl. You know, don't get out of hand. No more karaoke on Thursdays or Tuesdays or Wednesdays. And I tried that. You know, I did. I really gave it my all. But my motivations and my motives were completely in the wrong spot. And at that point, my alcoholism had already progressed so much that I needed a spiritual awakening. I needed a moment of clarity. I needed anything I could get at that point. And I started working for a company there, and it happened to be a casino. Yay! So I worked for a lot of casinos there because I couldn't hold a job. And if any of you suffer from the same disease I do, that might be in your story. I don't know. I could not hold on to a job. I couldn't show up to a job. If I did show up, it was really late, if I showed up at all. But as time went on, the old habits came back. The old drinking, norms came back for me, and here I am in a new state. So especially now I want to make people like me, because these people don't know me. I can start all over again, right? Thing is, I didn't start over again. I acted the same way I had always, because I'm an alcoholic, and that's what I do. When I had a good day, I would drink, right? When I'd have a bad day, I'd drink. Didn't matter. I got excited. If I got a promotion, that didn't happen. But if I were to get a promotion, I would drink. And it was awesome, I thought, Until I found out, the next morning when I sobered up that I had been 86 out of three different bars, and the cabbie had to bring me home, and he was still sitting outside my little one single wide trailer waiting for himself to get paid, And what happened was that I moved back in with my parents. I tried to move away and do another geographical to Elko, Nevada, which is not almost about, 200 miles from the Idaho border. It was really cold there. So I got to really like anything that was a liquor that made me warm and fuzzy. And that was any of them. And I did that, and it didn't work out. Surprise. So I moved back to my parents' house, out in Outfords, Reno, and my mom went on a trip to Arkansas to go see our family, the same family members I live with, and sure they had some stories to tell her, but she left for 2.5 weeks, and the one thing she told me before she left was, Candace, now I've talked to you about this before, I just don't want you to steal anything from me, okay, so you can stay here, but if I find out that you stole anything from me when I get back, you're out. Okay, Mom, I don't even know why you'd say that. How dare you say that to me? I'm your daughter. Yeah, because I was so trustworthy. And not even an hour went by after we took her to the airport. I got home, and not an hour went by that I didn't, before I started thinking about where I could find that key at to that lockbox. And it took me 2.5 days to find that key, and I tore that house apart, and I found it. But I was so nervous and excited all at the same time to get it open that I just finally just pried it open with a screwdriver because I didn't want to wait for the key to work. And I thought to myself as I was stealing the money, and she had a lot of different prescription medication in there for pain. And I thought to myself, man, I probably shouldn't be doing this. The second thought I had was, fuck it. And I did. And I sold everything that she had over the next week. And when she got home from her trip, I was getting ready to go out for the night on the money that I had stolen from her and sold the pills and gotten more money, and I was going to go out on that money. And she came into the restroom where I was getting ready, and she stood at the door, and I'll never forget, and I hope I never forget, the look on her face. And she looked at me and she said, I told you if you ever stole anything from me, you're out. You have 12 minutes to get out of my house. You dishonest, lying bitch, was her exact words. And while I try not to use profanity in my share, it's the gravity of the situation. Because I have to remember that. I have to remember the look in my mom's eyes when she said that to me. Now, why she said 12 minutes and not 10 or 15, I don't know. But she said, I have 12 minutes to get out of her house. And I cried profusely, and I was such a drama queen. And I was like, oh, my God. And I figured out, later on that evening at about 1 in the morning when I'm sitting in my car 2 blocks away because I'm so big and badass that that's as far as I went. And I slept in my car. And I figured out that morning that I was mad at her. That's why I cried. Don't get me wrong, I didn't cry because I felt bad that I stole all that money from her. In all about, I don't know, if you count everything, about $275, but I wasn't crying about that. I was crying because I was like, how dare her kick me out of her home? Doesn't she care? Isn't she what kind of mother does that? And at that point I became home. So I had my car, I had my little beater, and so I stayed in my car for about 2 months. And about a month and 3 weeks later, into that time, my mom called me on my cell phone that still, by the grace of God, worked. I don't know how that worked, but it did. And but if it wouldn't have, then I saved it by grace of God, because then I wouldn't have been able to get that phone call that was going to lead to an intervention. And my mom said, you can come home. Your stepdad and I have decided you can come home and you can take a shower and you can eat dinner with us, and then you have to leave in the morning. We just we were thinking you probably haven't taken a shower too much. And I was like, I'm good, you know. Little did she know I was going to trailer parks and taking showers in the restrooms, but I figured out a way, you know. Because my disease of alcoholism is nothing but resourceful. and it fought, you know, right along with me. I fought for a long time to not have to admit that I was anywhere close to an alcoholic. So I went home that night, and I got there in like 2 minutes, and she said, were you nearby? And I said, yeah, I've been staying like right there, and then you turn left on Rosewood. Yeah, I'm right there. And she was so angry, she almost slapped me. She said, I should, you know, knock you out. And I said, whoa, why are you getting all mad, Mom? I had already been drinking. And she said, I've been crying my eyes out every night not being able to sleep because I'm not sure if you're alive or dead or laying in a gutter or you've been raped, mutilated, and left in a field or buried somewhere out in the desert and you've been staying two freaking blocks away. Are you kidding me? You know? And so she did allow me to come inside, and I'll never forget, we had Jack in the Box, and that was like the best food I'd ever had in my life. And they sat me down, and then when my little brother came in, and he's 22 now, but my little brother came in and sat down, I knew something was up. They meant business, because my brother never came out of his room, came off his computer, and so he sat down, and my stepdad and my mom sat across from me, and they said, you know, we know you're doing something, we're not sure what it is, but you're messed up, and we want you to get help. And she said a big spiel, and I only remember parts of it because I was not clear-headed by any means. And one of the things she said was, she said, you know, do you even feel bad about stealing from your family? Do you even feel bad about lying all the times we've caught you in lies? And I looked at her and I said, you know what? Not a day goes by that I don't feel like total shit for what I did to you. I don't ever want to have to feel that anymore. And honestly, Mom, and honestly, Dad, I called him Dad. I said, honestly, Mom and Dad, you know, I'd rather die than have to live with the guilt that I'm carrying around on what I did to you. And after all that whole big old sentences I just said, the only thing my mom heard was, you want to die? And I said, you're damn right I do. And she said, well, here's the deal. You're going to get up in the morning at 8 a.m. and we're going to allow you to take your car, because after this we will take it away. And she said, we're going to allow you to take the car and drive yourself into Reno and go to Northern Nevada and check yourself in and tell them that you want to die. And that will be sure to get you help. And this is coming from my mother, who is still a practicing addict, and my father, who is a raging alcoholic. And this is the only way they knew to get me help, was to send me to the hospital and have me tell them in the emergency room that I wanted to die. There's not a day goes by that I'm not grateful for that conversation. And I went the next morning, I got up, I took a shower, I did like they asked, I got up and got in my car, and 2 days later I finally went to the emergency room. Because I tried to get a hold of, I tried to steal things, I did steal things, I didn't try, I did, from Walgreens, then I went to 7-Eleven, and I got alcohol from there, and then I went to another Rite Aid, and I stole a couple of makeup things, and took them back, and got money, and then I went and got more alcohol, and then I was on the phone with my drug dealer, and I was trying to get a hold of anybody I could, and little did I know, my mom used that drug dealer for other stuff, and so she'd already called him, and she already gave him the heads up, so he didn't have to call. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning on September 31st, I went to the parking lot of Northern Nevada Hospital in Reno, and I parked my car, and I drank the last of my Sailor Jerry bottle that I had, my half pint. That was my boyfriend for many years. And I got out and I locked, I remember shutting my door to my car and I locked it because it was one of those, it was an old car. And I had to lock it from the outside. And then I stood there and all of a sudden my feet just started moving and I started walking towards the emergency room entrance. And I was like, in my brain it was going like, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're not going to go in there, are you? You know, and I did. And And to this day, I really believe that that was my higher power absolutely doing what my legs couldn't do for me. And he walked me in there. And when I walked in, it was 3-something in the morning. I don't really remember exact time, but there was this wonderful, nice lady there, young girl, and she was like, "Hi, how can I help you?" And I'm so happy. And I looked at her and I said, "I want to die." She said, "Oh my, let's get you right back." And there was no waiting. Don't follow that advice, though, if anything happens, please don't do that. And from there, you know, I was put on a 72-hour, 5150 hold, and they stripped me down, you know, and gave me this little gown that did not anywhere close to the clothes on me. And my mom came and saw me 2 days later before they took me by ambulance to the mental ward. They had a county-funded mental hospital in Reno. And that was my new hotel. And she came down and saw me. She brought me a few pairs of underwear and like a shirt and a pair of shorts, I think, or sweats. No, it was sweats, because she figured if she's going to the mental hospital, she don't need nothing nice. Let's just bring her some sweats. And I remember my mom did not cry once while she was in there, and she said, "I'll see you around." I think she said, you know. And she left, and I was like, I can't believe my mom has left, you know. No, but at that point, I had put my mom through hell again and again and again. And she was tired. She was so tired. And I'm so, there's another thing that I don't ever not be grateful for every day, that my mom turned around and she walked away. Because I see so many people come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they still have a lot of yes. And they still think that it's going to be okay. They'll figure something out, you know. And they also still have family that are willing to act and behave in codependent ways. And my parents were done. And I'm so thankful that they said, "We're done. We're done. Figure it out, you know, because we're not going to watch you die." And I went to the mental hospital. I was there for 9 days. I have it in my notes. I was in there for 9 days, and that is where I had my moment of clarity, and it was a big moment of clarity. I was sitting in a, I had yelled at the front staff in a very derogatory manner because I wanted a damn cigarette, and they wouldn't give me one because I guess they had this rule, like there's no smoking in the mental hospital. I don't know. Lame. And so I yelled and I yelled at this lady, and finally I just remember her pushing a little tiny white pill, round pill, against the across the counter. I said, "Go ahead, why don't you go ahead and take that?" And I said, "Whatever, fine." Like, I don't know how much longer, 2 minutes seemed like a long time. She goes, "Why don't you go ahead and walk back to your room?" I went back to my room, and the hallway was all, "What?" And then I got down and I sat down on my bed with the room with no door, with the door hinge and an opening, and I felt something wet on my shirt, and I was like, "What the hell, man?" And then I realized I was drooling. And that was it. You know. And then the moment of clarity happened, and that moment of clarity was pretty much to the effect of, what have I done? How has it come to this? And I cannot live like this anymore. And all of a sudden, just like that, I no longer wanted to pray to die anymore. As soon as I slept that off for about 16 hours, I came to, and I went to the front lady, the same lady I yelled at, and I said, "I'd like to talk. I'd like to do another evaluation. Can I have a chance, you know?" She said, "Yeah, they were going to do it today anyway, so just have a seat. We'll get to you." I was like, "Okay." Like, "Go watch whatever they have on TV." I'm like, "Fine." And they called me in, and they asked me the same questions they had been asking me for, like, the last 8 days. And this time I answered them all different, you know, and they just ask you a simple number of questions. If you've ever been committed, you probably know, are you a harm to yourself and others? Do you feel that you want to hurt yourself or anyone else? And I said, "No. In fact, no. I want to live." "Oh, okay, okay, Ms. J." And then they said, I don't want to make my head around. And then they said, you know, "Do you still want to die like you did yesterday?" And I said, "No, I want to live." They said, "Do you understand that you might have a problem with drugs and alcohol?" And I said, "Absolutely, I do, and I want help." You know, and I said, "Absolutely, I do." I said, and I know that, and I understand that now, and I really want help, and I really don't want to be here anymore. I think that I can go get help, you know. And they said, well, here's the deal. We're going to promise that you get that help, because on contention that you leave here, if you do not leave here and go straight to where we tell you to go, which is a homeless shelter that had attached to it a women's rehab, we'll put a warrant out for your arrest. We can do that, because you are technically on a 5150 hold, and we can do that in the state of Nevada. So I said, sure, no problem, whatever you want me to do. And they said, okay, you need to call someone to come pick you up. And I said, no problem, I'll call my mom. They go, no, we already called her. She doesn't want anything to do with you, and said, please do not call her. I went, kind of cracked my neck. That kind of hurt. Okay, that sounds all right. I said, well, call my stepdad then. And they said, we've already done that, and he is, on the contrary, willing to come pick you up. And so he came and picked me up, and I was so excited because I was like, I just can't wait to get back home, you know. So glad that thing's behind me. And it was a long ordeal. And he picked me up, and I got in the truck, and I put my little rolling suitcase and backpack in there. And I got in the truck, and he goes, okay, where's this place at? And I go, you don't remember how to get home, Dad? He goes, oh, no. Martin, you're not going home. I'm going home. He goes, you're going to this place on blah, 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 Record Street in Reno, Nevada. And I said, what? I go, you're not actually going to take me there, are you? And he's already driving there. Yeah, he's already driving there. And I just started shaking, and he dropped me off, and he looked at me when I got my stuff. He goes, get your stuff out. Sure, come on. And I got my stuff out, and here's another gratitude. Extremely grateful that he looked at me in the eyes, and he said, your mother and I are tired of seeing you kill yourself, and we're not going to watch it for one more minute. So get your head out of your ass and figure out what the hell you're going to do and start taking care of yourself and get some help. Goodbye. And he got in the truck and he drove away. Thank God. I didn't think that at the time. I was scared, shitless. I thought I was going to get killed. There was all these people looking around at me, and they were trying to see like what they could take from me. That's what I thought. And within like 3 days, I had a good piece of cardboard, a couple of sleeping bags, the Salvation Army kind of dropped off, and I actually had made friends on the road, on the streets. And my friend Amber's back there, so we say that to each other, on the streets. And I got to see what it was really like on the streets. And I was out there for about another month and a half, you know, until I finally figured out that something had to get better than it was getting. I had stayed clean and sober out on the streets. I don't know how. Oh, yes, I do. My higher power. And also every day I would get up and I would make my sleeping bag, roll it up, you know, and then I'd get my stuff, and then I'd go walk to a Catholic church that was down in downtown Reno, because I had called my father and my dad here in Fresno, and he told me, whatever you do, after he got over the shock that his only daughter was on the streets, he said, whatever you do, I don't want you around those people, so I want you to get to like somewhere that's safe. I don't care what it is, go to a school, go to, just sit out on the steps, you know. And I was like, a church, I can go to a church, I know where a church is. He's like, okay, go to a church. So every day for like weeks, I don't know how long, I went to a Catholic church and I sat on their steps, and I never went in, and I never went in and got down on my knees and prayed. I just stayed there and I watched all the other people go in and go to Mass. You know, and I was so intrigued, cause I would watch everything about them, and I just knew that for that time I was safe. I finally got a call from my dad at the homeless shelter where I was sleeping out in front of, and they came out and said, is Santa's daughter? And I said, yeah, I'm right here. And I was just getting ready to walk to that church, that same church I just spoke about. And my dad, I got on the phone, and my dad said, I found you a rehab. And I said, you did? And he said, yeah, I've been working on it for like over 2 weeks, and I finally found a place that you don't have to be straight out of jail, you don't have to have children, and you don't have to have a severe mental illness, you know. And I said, well, Dad, I did just get out of 5150, you know. He's like, don't worry, I talked to him, you're good. I was like, okay. And he said that place is the Salvation Army in Fresno, and he said, I'll be there to get you in a week and a half. And I said, what? No. I said, Dad, I can't take it that long, and I won't make it. Is there any possible way you can get here sooner? And he got really quiet, and I know now that he was crying. And he came back on the phone, and I said, Dad, are you there? And he said, yeah, I'll be there on Sunday. And then this was on Thursday. And he showed up on Sunday after getting in a really bad accident on the way there on Donner Pass. Got a really bad accident. And And he made it, you know? And he said, nothing could have stopped me, not even a huge flat tire on the snow and the rain, and I'm here. And when he got there, all my friends that I was, like, my peeps out on the street, they were like, hey, you're her dad? And he was like, yes, I am. Nice to meet you. What's your name? And he was, like, so scared, because I told him, I purposely told him, go bring your Mercedes in. So he brought his truck, and they were like, can we go with you? And he was like, I'm sorry, excuse me? And they said, can we go with you? We're ready to get help, too. We're going to do what Candace is doing, you know? And he said, I'm sorry, I think that's great. Please keep doing that and try to find some help. But they only got one bed, and it's taken me weeks to find it and get it for her. And so we left, and I got into the Salvation Army the following week, and I stayed there for about 11 and a half months. I graduated the program after 6 months, and in that time, in the first 30 days that I was there, it's mandatory that you get a sponsor. Another gratitude, so thankful for that. And my first sponsor was through the other fellowship, and she relapsed after like the first two times I had met with her, so I had to get a new one. And I met a wonderful young lady that was like half my age. Her name was Heather R., and she's a wonderful part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm thankful for her every day. And she started to take me through the steps. And when Bill H. had asked me to speak at this meeting, he'd made it really nicely clear to me that this meeting is, their purpose really is to talk about my experience with the steps. And so I'm going to do that really quickly, and then I'll shut up, and you guys can have the floor back. You know, the steps for me, the way she worked them with me was really straightforward. She was very blunt, and she didn't do anything for me, and by that I mean anything. If she asked me to meet with her at her house, I had to take the bus, and let me correct, I had to take 4 buses to get there. And then I had to walk another half mile or so, maybe quarter mile, maybe I'm exaggerating, to get to her house. And I always used to ask her, like, but girl, you got a car right there, why can't you just come get me? And she goes, that's funny, maybe it was somebody else. I thought you said you were willing to go to any length for your sobriety. And I was like, crap, I said that, didn't I? So before we even started on step one, to get prepared for that, to get me ready for that, she had me make a reservations list, and I didn't know what that meant, so I asked her, and she said, it's like making a dinner reservation. Have you ever done that? I said, yeah, a long time ago, and it was only once, because usually I just go to like Home Walls or Denny's. But anyway, go ahead, go on. And she said, it's like when you make a dinner reservation, so you're like, you know, if we're going to have a party of eight, we need to reserve that table, or else it won't be there when we get there. And reservation list for your alcoholism is like, if such and such happens, I probably will drink. You know, if I lose my job I have, I'm going to drink. And so if I lost all the friends I have, I'm going to drink. So I had a list of like 19 things. It was insane. Like how many things how much fear ruled my life. But I made a reservation list, and I wrote, I had a lot underlined on it. She also asked me to call her every single day. It didn't matter if I had a good day, a bad day. If nothing was going on, I was sitting there like, just didn't care to call her. I did that. She asked me to write down all the ways that I was powerless over alcohol. And to really think about that one, because I was like, I don't know, just like when I drink, I can't stop. She's all, really, that's it? How about like you're powerless over being a good person to your family? How about you're powerless over alcohol? Because when you drink alcohol, you don't pay any attention to your little brother who's just looking up to you and just wants to hang out. You know, what about that? You know. And the last thing she asked me to do was think of anything in this world that was more powerful than Candace and make that my higher power. She wanted to get me moving through those steps because she was afraid for me, and as I get afraid for my sponsees, that they're not going to make it, you know, because I see so many people come in and they don't make it. And I hope that all of you that are in this room tonight, especially newcomers, please keep coming back. No matter if you hear something that you want to hear or don't want to hear, just keep coming back. Gets better. And step two, you know, step two I had to completely come to believe. I had to believe in something that I didn't believe in. That a power greater than myself could restore my insane thinking to sanity. And in step three, I had my spiritual awakening, and my obsession for alcohol was lifted. And that came with doing the third step prayer in a very different and unique way that she did it at a little church that was right down the street from where I was at in the rehab house I was in. And when we got done with that prayer, it was like all the heaviness that I'd been carrying around my whole life was gone. And I was free for just a moment, you know. And the thought that came through my mind was, you're going to be okay as long as you keep doing what this girl right here tells you to do. You know, whatever she suggests, doesn't matter if she says, paint your knees yellow and you will probably stay sober. I'd be like, I will paint them yellow and I'll do my elbows too. You know, I was willing to do whatever it took. I was desperate. And I'm thankful for that desperation still today. And step four, I waited on 3.5 months to do step four because I was not willing to look at my resentment towards people because I didn't want to be mad at anyone. I just wanted people to like me, you know. So she had me read a book called Drop the Rock, and it talked about holding a rock. Literally, she had me hold a rock that had jagged edges on the side and smooth on the other, and she had me hold that jagged edge rock against my hand, and she said, I want you to squeeze it, and when it starts to hurt, I want you to let me know. About 10 minutes later, we're talking about this fourth step she's trying to get me to do to save my life, and she goes, hey, Candace, by the way, how's your hand? I go, it hurts, but I got this. It's okay. And she's like, okay, just let me know, you know, and then another 10 minutes go by. She goes, hey, Candace, isn't your hand starting to hurt? I go, and by this time, my hand's like shaking. And she says, isn't it hurting? And I go, yeah. And now it's kind of starting to hurt really bad. And she goes, Candace, drop the rock. You know? And she had me drop that rock, and she said that I didn't have to carry around that pain that I had anymore, and I needed to get it out. I needed to be honest about it. I needed to start my fourth step and finish it. Let's do this. I went home that night to my rehab house, and I wrote that fourth step. And then we went over it 2 weeks later, and there was another moment of clarity there. My sixth step, I still try to do each day because I got a lot of character defects. I have to become willing. I still have to become willing to let those go because a lot of them I really, really like. And I'm all, no, but that's my favorite. Control. That's one. You know, the biggest thing I learned and I've worked on and I'm still growing on is to learn how to let go of envy and jealousy because I see what other people have in this program and it's very easy for me, and I can only speak about me, it's very easy for me to get envious and jealous, you know. Wow, I wish I had that. You know, for the fact they have 32 years of sobriety, you know, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of action taken, and that's a lot of one day at a time. And I'm still real young in sobriety. I have a lot to learn. And I hope I keep learning. Steps 8 and 9, I had to come to realization that I had handled personal relationships in my life like crap. I was not a good daughter, granddaughter, sister, friend. I didn't have any real friendships at all until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my best friend tonight is just standing up. Sorry to call you out. I couldn't keep a friendship for an hour, especially if you didn't have the kind of liquor I wanted or the kind of drugs I wanted. So to have a friend that I've had since I was in rehab show up for me tonight, to have all of those people in that row show up tonight, to have these two gentlemen here show up tonight, and to have all of you show up tonight for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, who cares who the speaker is, who cares that I'm up here. What I care about is that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life, and it continues to do that every day. If there's one last thing I can say is become willing, become desperate, and surrender everything to whatever you choose for your higher power to be, man. Telephone pole, take it, whatever, because life can get so good. You know, that girl who couldn't hold a job, couldn't do anything without stealing money and things from her mom, I just got offered a job, and I got to give a nice 2-week notice with a nice letter of resignation to a job I was at almost 3 years. And now I have a job that's at a company where I'm doing what I am going to school to do for the last 3 years. I live with my grandma, and I get to see her and take care of her. I get to go to school full time. I thought I was dumb. I thought I didn't have any brain cells left to be able to go to school, and I'll be graduating next October. Thank you. And the biggest thing, though, forget all of that. The biggest thing is that today I go to a CCCAA roundup, and a gentleman that's sitting there having dinner with me at my table, because I always make sure I sit with people mostly that I don't know, and he asked me a whole bunch of questions about how I work the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, how long I've been sober, what do I do today to stay sober, and I told him all those things, and I answered his questions. His name was Bill H., and he asked me to share his 3.5 months ago, and that's what I'm grateful for, and that's what I'm thankful for. Please keep coming back. It gets good. Thank you.